Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. It's just gone 8 o'clock and Theresa May's cabinet has broken up. The Prime Minister came out of number 10 to give a speech with protesters heckling at the background, announcing that her deal had gone through. With her heart and her soul, she said she thought it was the best outcome for Britain. But how many of her colleagues agreed? I'm Fraser Nelson and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth to discuss. So James, cabinet has just broken up. We're just beginning to get reports. I imagine journalists will spend most of tonight trying to work out what's happened. As always, I imagine you're a few steps ahead of them. So do we know anything about the cabinet discussion and how support split down? How many people would have backed the Prime Minister? How many would have opposed her?
I think the fact that Theresa May called the cabinet debate impassioned and it went on for 5 hours shows you that this wasn't a simple matter of people saying, Prime Minister, this is a great deal. Let's go and sell it to the country. Now, there's a slight dispute in our office. I've heard that 10 ministers spoke against the deal at cabinet. My colleague Katie Ball thinks that the number's 11 and that my source has miscounted. But I think whether it's 10 or 11...
a third of the cabinet,
ultimately,
basically.
You know, it doesn't matter. If it was 10, which is my number, is the lower number, I still think that is quite a big deal. That you've got 10 ministers speaking against proceeding with this, because Theresa May now needs to pass this through the House of Commons. This isn't like that simply by executive action she can approve this deal. She now needs to, and also
these are people she handpicked for her cabinet,
and these are people who have, I'm not impugning their motives at all, because I think these are incredibly difficult decisions for anyone, but these are people who have jobs to lose. This, that, if a cabinet is split like this, what is the Tory parliamentary party going to be split like? One, so how does this deal get through the House of Commons? Secondly, Theresa May talked in her statement outside about how some of the most difficult choices were about the Northern Ireland backstop. I think that reveals that if the cabinet found this difficult, are the DUP going to be less unionist than the cabinet?
Yeah, because it's not supposed to be Northern Ireland backstop. The whole point of her deal was that she'd managed to get rid of a Northern Ireland backstop.
I'm not sure if that was a slip of the tongue or something else, but It is there.
Freudian.
And then the third thing I think is, who is going to sell this deal to Leave voters, who now make up 70% of the Tory electorate? Because if you've got 10 people at cabinet or 11 people at cabinet, that means that there are not going to be very many people who are Brexiteers who are going to be putting, as we talked this morning about, putting the pom-poms on and going out to sell this thing, right? And at the same time, you have a Jacob Rees-Mogg blasting against the deal, you have Boris Johnson blasting against the deal. Who goes and reassures Tory Brexiteers that this is the Brexit that they voted for? I think that is the question. I think you can't help but feel for Theresa May tonight in this respect, which is, you know, getting the deal with Brussels was tough. Getting it through the cabinet was even more difficult. But the final challenge is the most difficult. She now has to persuade a parliament in which she has no majority to vote for her deal, a deal that her cabinet was only 2-1 in favour of.
And also, I mean, I don't think Theresa May is even necessarily out of the woods when it comes to keeping her cabinet intact.
Of course, because the resignations haven't really started yet. That's assuming there will be some.
Yeah, well, we saw what happened with Chequers.
Yeah.
After Chequers, there was a long meeting, and then a rather triumphant Theresa May came out and said that everyone had agreed to this. About 48 hours later, we had David Davis resigning and then Boris Johnson. So the numbers that we know don't really support this agreement does suggest that this could still be possible. And of course, we're just starting to get accounts of what happened in the room, but I'm hearing that Esther McVeigh was particularly unhappy.
Right.
And she asked for there to be a vote around the cabinet table.
An actual vote counted. Yeah. Because right now, because you say 11, James says 10, both of you will be relying, I imagine, on other cabinet contacts who will be keeping the score around the table themselves. But there won't be a formal vote because this sort of thing doesn't happen.
And so Esther McVeigh asked for that at the end of the meeting, I'm told, and she was refused that request.
Right.
So that's one person who we should watch, I think, in the coming days. But then also, just if you think about the other, whether it's 10 or 9 cabinet ministers who don't like this deal, when they get, you know, out of that meeting and they start speaking to their supporters, to, you know, their colleagues, they might start to have second thoughts about whether what James was touching on. If you are a minister, technically speaking, you should be prepared to go and defend government policy. Some have been keeping quite a low profile anyway as it is, but I think there will be some serious soul-searching about whether they can actually do that in the coming months to follow.
I also think it's worth bearing in mind the point that you made to us this morning, Fraser, which is, you know, there are some ministers who think that the moment of maximum impact to quit is on the day or on the eve of the parliamentary vote to say, you know, I've gone along with this for as long as I can, but I cannot walk through the division lobby in favour of this. So I don't think we should think that this is all over now. But I think we also saw in Theresa May's statement tonight how she is going to try and frame this deal. She basically said there were three choices. Her deal, no deal, or no Brexit. Now, she will try and argue that no deal is scary. And it is scary. I don't deny that for a second. I don't think anyone should deny that for a second. I think there is also an irony here, but one of the reasons it is so scary is because this government, of which she is the Prime Minister, has done so little work on attempting to mitigate the impacts of no deal.
So, Katie, do we know who the ringleaders were in this cabinet revolt?
So, hearing that the people who were the most vocal in saying that they did not like this, they did not want to support it, were figures including Sajid Javid, Jeremy Hunt, both former Remainers, then Andrea Leadsom, Esther McVeigh, Penny Mordaunt, and also Gavin Williamson.
Right.
And we can also, I haven't been told this personally, but it's quite clear Dominic Raab, as we heard before, had strong reservations. So you can put him in the anti-this agreement pile, I suspect.
Yeah, and he was pulling a huge face after he'd been in to see Theresa May last night. So James, do we see here, I mean, like Jeremy Hunt and Sajid Javid, both Remainers, both are being spoken of as potential candidates to succeed Theresa May. So do we see a bit of leadership here? Because everybody around that table will be wondering, if she goes, who would be next? It's impossible to separate that consideration from what they were discussing tonight.
I think you can either call it leadership or concern about the future of a Conservative Party. Katie was just saying that Gavin Williamson expressed concern about the deal, right? Now, I think that is worrying because no one in the cabinet knows the DUP better than he does, right? He clearly thinks that they're not going to buy this. If the DUP won't buy this, you're going to have to rely on sizable Labour support to get this deal through. Now, for the column this week in the magazine, I've run some kind of very rough numbers. So let's imagine that you get the ERG Brexiteer Ultra Revolt down to 20, which I think is quite optimistic.
Right, from, that's from starting from a number of about 80.
Well, they claim 80, yeah. But you know, they think that they've got 40 to vote against.
Right, so what's to say we can rely on 20 ERG rebels?
Yeah, I mean, that is a minimum number on the first vote, certainly. Then you say you get half a dozen Tories voting against it from a kind of Joe Johnson perspective. We want to stay in the EU, that'd be better, right? Again, I think these are very small C conservative estimates. Yeah. Then let's be a bit more optimistic. Let's think they get 25 Labour MPs in a total of abstentions and active votes for the deal.
That would balance each other out.
But if a DUP are against the deal, right, the government still loses. Now, I think that this means that you are looking at the only way you can pass this is with wholesale Labour support. Or you do the most risky thing that might just work, which is two votes. So you bring it to the House once, it gets rejected, you bring it back another time. But again, I think the ill feeling that will inject into the Conservative Party will be a real risk for its future. Now, Tories have got very good at, with Corbyn, equating their party interest with the national interest. But I think you can genuinely make a case here, which is, you know, how do you hold the Tory party together after this? You know, and I think this is what is motivating a lot of cabinet ministers' concerns, which is, you know, they're not fans of this deal, but they know that they are in the middle of the Tory party on Europe, not anywhere near the Brexiteer end. And if they can't take it, what are their colleagues and what are the voters going to think of it?
So, Casey, we haven't heard a squeak, really, from Theresa May's defenders. I mean, the best news she's had today is pretty much Tim Montgomery on Twitter saying he thinks that that he would back her, but there's been nobody else. So who is, they're not speaking out right now, but who did she have behind her in cabinet?
Well, I think you have the usual suspects in cabinet who obviously like this plan more than others, people like Philip Hammond. But I think what's interesting is, if you're looking at her unlikely defenders, I'm hearing that Michael Gove was actually more sympathetic than people thought he might be. Okay. And also Geoffrey Cox. That's not to say that they thought, hey, this is a great deal. But instead, they both seem to agree that they backed with a heavy heart, is what I'm hearing from people who were in that room. So I don't think it means you can send them on to the Mar show to say that this is the right way forward. But I think that is where you might start to see the Brexiteers who see that this is the least worst option.
Right.
I think this is where it all comes down to, which is, as we said in the leader this week, it's very hard to make a positive case for this deal. You can make a case that it is better than the alternatives from where we currently are, but to make a positive case is very difficult. And I think this is, you know, weirdly enough, we are now in a situation where people are left having to confront what the alternatives are. Yep. And her framing of this will have some success, because there is obviously some validity to the argument. But given that this is the course she has decided to go down, and given that if she basically come out of his cabinet meeting and said, oh, we're going back to Brussels to renegotiate this, the EU probably would have issued the most amazing sigh of regret and irritation. You know, where do you go from here? This question is not a simple question. And I don't envy anyone who had to make that choice today, because where the country is now does not make things simple.
But can I give you guys a positive case for this? It is as follows. That thanks to the pressure that the British people exerted on the government via the referendum, there is now control over the borders. This is a massive thing. Many European countries would like it. Now Britain is about to claim it. Not only that, but the money we give to the EU is about to be cut from 10 billion a year to less than a billion a year, a saving of 50 billion over Parliament. Not only that, there's control of the farms, now finally back in Britain. Not only that, control of the fisheries too, and the jurisdiction of the ECJ severely cut back. Is that not better than what we have before? By the way, I'm just pushing this. This is a positive case that somebody can make. I'm amazed nobody has made it, but what's the argument against that?
I mean, last night someone called me up and I ran to answer the phone because someone I thought might resign on the Remain wing of the party. And they weren't. They were actually making a better case, I think, than Number 10 are making this deal.
You shouldn't have picked up then.
Which is as follows. You know, the referendum results are a deeply split country. This person's argument was that the thing that motivated the majority of Leave voters was control, particularly control of immigration, right? Personally, I think sovereignty in the round was more important, but let's just go with this person's argument. Why 48% of the country voted to stay in was not any great love of the European project, but a fear of the economic dislocation that would follow exit. This Minister of State's argument to me, who is not a fan of Theresa May, as it should be said, I think, was that this deal gets the UK out of free movement while basically keeping it in the EU's economic structures. And so, weirdly enough, you can actually argue it delivers on the referendum result, in that the referendum result was 52-48, not 60-40 or 70-30.
I think the problem for Theresa May is that as soon as it was announced that this deal was in the offing, we have seen Brexiteers and the UDP dominate the narrative. So I do think there are some things that she can claim as victories. If you can look on the positive side, you can look at, for example, the Commons Fishery Policy. It does, despite the letter from the Scottish Conservatives today about some concerns, it does seem that the UK have actually taken some control there. That, you could say, was a sovereign win. But it's all within framing, and I think it does come back to the fact that lots of people voted for Brexit for lots of different reasons. So this deal isn't going to satisfy every single Brexit voter. But what Number 10 are banking on is it's going to satisfy a large chunk of them, at least. So those who cared about things, you know, like immigration. But I think if you are someone who voted for Brexit because you love free trade, you are not going to be happy.
It would be pretty disingenuous if, like me, you wanted a global Britain kind of vision of Brexit. You claim this as a triumph. But the thing is, James, that given that there are positive arguments to be made, first of all, it's catastrophically bad handling that all we've had today is people attacking Theresa May's deal, her herself really struggling to say anything about it. Even the choreography of coming outside Number 10, of giving her statement, of people shouting, it was as if a war was going on outside, almost. So this is not, we've got the Brexit you wanted. This is, my government's on the brink of collapse, and to prove it, here's a band of protesters baying at me from the...
There's self-indulgence everywhere. I saw, when Katie and I were waiting for this cabinet meeting to end, we saw Alistair Birch on the TV basically saying, well, you voted to give up control, so don't complain about being a rule taker. What kind of argument is that for this deal? I mean, it is, I think that Number 10 need to get on the front foot on this, and they need to be honest about the trade-offs she's made and explain why they've made them. And I mean, they also need to make this argument, which is they're trying to reflect the 52-48 referendum result. The problem is that Theresa May, in the first months of her premiership, acted like the 48% could go whistle, while she was going to prove that she was the true tribune of the 52%, despite having been a Remainer herself. I mean, I think there is a case to be made for this deal, but as Czech has showed, if you don't get out and make your case PDQ, your opponents define the debate.
And Katie, we've got the Daily Express behind her today, quite emphatically. The Daily Mail seems to be broadly sympathetic to her. The Sun seems to be quite robust and coherent in saying that the Brexit that they supported is not really delivered by this deal. I guess the Telegraph will have to see what they think of it, but she doesn't seem to have that many cheerleaders. If Michael Gove, the best he can do is a heavy heart, that's what you're saying, what's your contacts tell you. So Michael Gove isn't going to be taking his heavy heart around television studios.
Yeah, though I do think if you look at the Fleet Street press, actually Theresa May's fortunes have gone upwards in recent months, partly because editors have changed from various papers. So the Daily Mail is now much more pro a Brexit compromise. The Daily Express is much more pro a Brexit compromise. And the Sun was always going for this free trade Brexit, which is why I don't see how they could really ever get behind this, whereas the Daily Mail was always more protectionist Brexit.
Yeah.
So you can see how I actually think when it comes to the printed press, Number 10 probably feeling quite happy at the way the stars have aligned on this compared to what David Cameron had to face when he was going through that renegotiation process. The problem is that you still need to have, ideally, people who campaign for Brexit saying they're happy with what Brexit is going to be. And if you look and you think about the most prominent figures in the EU referendum for the Leave side, I think you are struggling right now to see any of them going out and saying, this is what you voted for, I hope you're happy. In fact, you might see them going on television saying the complete opposite. And I think that should worry Number 10 slightly.
Well, let's see what the rest of the night brings. Katie and James, thanks very much indeed. You can subscribe to this podcast, Coffeehouse Shots, on the iTunes Store or to the magazine itself from just £1 a week on spectator.co.uk/subscribe. We'd also like to thank Joseph Druhan, who are the wine company. We're having a wine tasting session downstairs and we nicked a bottle of their lovely Chablis, which we can all heartily recommend. So thank you, Joseph Druhan.